And they had thought, as you thought, that Allah would never send anyone as a messenger.
All right, so let's repeat these three verses that we learned today in this episode. I'll ask the brothers to please repeat after me. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وأنا ظننا أن لن تقول الإنس والجن على الله كذبا
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وأنا ظننا أن لن تقول الإنس والجن على الله كذبا
أحسنتم وأنه كان رجال من الإنس يعوذون برجال من الجن فزادوهم رهقا
وأنه كان رجال من الإنس يعوذون برجال من الجن فزادوهم رهقا
أحسنتم. And the last verse of this episode, وَأَنَّهُمْ ظَنُّوا كَمَا ظَنَنْتُمْ أَن لَّن يَبْعَثَ اللَّهُ أَحَدًا
وَأَنَّهُمْ ظَنُّوا كَمَا ظَنَنْتُمْ أَن لَّن يَبْعَثَ اللَّهُ أَحَدًا
صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And that were the verses of Surah Al-Jinn, verses number 5, 6, and 7. For this episode, we will conclude, inshallah, with the salawat on Muhammad and his pure progeny.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about Islam. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5 of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. Peace and greetings from Tehran. You're listening to Iran Radio. And today's programming is more than just the schedule. Of course, it's an invitation to reflect, to learn, and to feel connected. Let's begin. First, it's a new segment of radio productions. Then we tuned into A to Z of life. Next, it's time for Israel Watch to round out the hour. Keep it locked in. We've got more for you.
Joining me this week is Leonid Savin. He He is the chief analyst of the Sargat Institute, headed by the famed Russian philosopher Alexander Dugin. He's one of Russia's top experts on the multipolar world and spends most of his time traveling the world, Venezuela, Iran, and next week he's off to Cuba. Mr. Seven, thank you for joining me. First of all, has the multipolar world already arrived, and how do you see it developing?
It depends from what point of view we'll see on multipolarity. You know, there's different theories, different scholars introduced this term, for example, in the 60s, and American scholars like Deutsch, Singer, proposed one vision of multipolarity, based mostly on positivist science. And of course, the pole means connected with physical geography. And in some sense, it's connected with bipolarity order. I mean, balance of Soviet Union and the United States at this time. So there is another point of view, a proposal, for example, by John Mersheim, the different types of multipolarity, unbalanced multipolarity or balanced multipolarity. This point of view of nuclear multipolarity, that nuclear powers already kind of poles. Pakistan, Israel, in this sense, also actors of multipolarity. But for my opinion, it's better to rethink about what is pole. For example, I proposed in my book, Ordo Pluriversaris, point of view that Martin Heidegger told about pole. It's originally Greek word and also connected with polis, with politeia. And Heidegger told that it is kind of center of being of people. And his view, it Greek people, but we also can speak about Iranian people, about Chinese people, about Russian people. And from this point of view, there's many poles.
Because it seems that the Western model, if you like, based around NATO, is a kind of empire that's run from Washington, of Europe increasingly becoming vassals of Washington. But is the idea of multipolarity, the idea that there is no center to this empire? You look at Russia, China, Iran, they have a kind of friendship, but they all have their own sovereign interests. Is that the difference between the multipolar world and the Western idea?
Yes, of course, and it depends on what view. Because Chinese people not see the world future, God, like we Russians or Iranian people look on all these phenomena. And there's kind of Western type of point of view, to need to control the world, that only one Western civilization exists. And from our point of view, there are many civilizations. Chinese civilization, Iranian civilization, Turkish civilization, etc. And of course, there is kind of interest of to provide security for our sphere of influence. And if we speak about multipolarity, I see this contemporary moment like emerging multipolarity.
There's historically been a great deal of mistrust between Russia and Iran. How do you see their relationship now? Do you think it's strong enough to resist the Western desires to damage or destroy them both?
Yes, we have some historical conflicts between Persia and Russian Empire, but at the time we have very good relations during the same period. For example, Russian troops assisted to suppress coup in Tigran in November 1916, when Turkish and German again tried to reorganize and to catch the power in Persia. And then it was time of Soviet Union, and of course relation was not good because of Islamic revolutions. But then we developed very good economical, political ties on high level, and for last years we see that also kind of public diplomacy development between countries. Of course, we need more cooperate with Iranian people, and because we have the same vision on the global world to assist oppressed people, the same vision on Palestine, for example, the same vision on our common enemies like United States and collective West.
Because I'm speaking to some Russian people, and there's an idea that Russia doesn't really understand Iran, Iranian culture or history. you've been to Iran recently, I think a couple of years ago. How did you find the country, and what do you think could be done to create more trust between the two countries?
For Russians, ordinary people, Iran is amazing country. It's a very ancient civilization that very interesting to see different aspects, because it's not only one ethnic group. It's like Russia consists of many ethnic groups and many historical, cultural customs, tradition, etc. But for my opinion, for some last years, Karzadegi is coming back. Idea of proposed Jalil Ali Ahmad, that the Iranian people are poisoned by the West, and now it seems a little bit pro-Western trends inside of Iran, and a kind of MTV television, kind of Western dress of woman, man, etc. And I think it's not good. But from another point of view, I think technical modernization that's good for developing countries, despite of sanctions provided by the West against Iran.
Do you see Iran as strong at the moment? Were you impressed about in their war with Israel? Who won the war against Israel?
Of course, I'm an external person who can analyze only by objective news coming from different sources. From my point, yes, and because Israel also stopped aggressions, and it seems that Iran have enough power to resist. And last news from different sources have kind of confirmation that Iran prepares for any type of new aggression and would like to be more strongest than before.
And has the United States, do you think, accepted the multipolar world under their new president, Donald Trump? Is Trump adjusting their policy back towards their own hemisphere? Should Venezuela be worried?
America First is not about multipolarity. It's very clear. Even during time of Barack Obama, they proposed idea of leadership about multilateralism. It's kind of pseudo-multipolarity, and the United States, of course, seems like a leader of global war. And Donald Trump would like to reorganize foreign policy, first of all, back to South America. It's in Latin America, experts and analysts told that it's kind of doctrine Monroe number two, and so what Trump doing now. I mean, pressure on Venezuela, pressure on Panama, other countries, but he also interested in Asia, because the real economical rise in Asia, in China, in Japan, in Korea, for many years ago. So he very afraid the rise of China, and of course it's threat number one for the United States and for Trump. So he try to balance, and how it's possible, I don't know, because really economical system in United States now is very weak. He tried to bring more of assault back to United States. Why he pressure on European Union, this idea of new tariffs, also pressure on Japan and other partners.
Do you think he's doing a good job, or do you think he's understanding that the world has changed? One journalist said to me in Asia that Trump understands the changing realities of the world, but everything he's doing is still damaging their interests.
I think nobody wants hot conflicts and new wars, but everyone understands that time of United States is gone. So they would like to rebalance and try to find more opportunities. For example, Saudi Arabia, they organized a pact with Pakistan, defense pact. Another country is interested to more cooperation with BRICS club, joined to Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and to reorganize contacts with neighbor countries like Turkey do with Iraq, for example, and ideas new corridors and new transport routes. So many actors who think about future, they understand that type of United States is gone, like main world power.
And is Europe too slow to respond to the changing realities of the world? It seems Europe is still stuck believing the world hasn't changed when it has? Are they too slow to recognize it?
The problem of Europe is Brussels bureaucracy. I mean European Union institutions, because they are real very slow and they depend on the United States. Every country separately can do a great job, for example, like Hungary. United States not provided sanctions against Hungary to buy Russian oil and gas, for example. And some countries also balanced. But in general, European Union is very bad project. It's mostly dying. And ordinary people understand that very well in the end of Europe. So it's mostly problem of Brussels bureaucracy.
And is it in Europe's interest to have good relations with Russia? And why has that not happened?
In 19th century, Russian philosopher Nicholas Danilevsky told about root of the fears of Europeans on Russia. He told very simple, just look on the map, you will see that Europe is just a small western peninsula of continent. And there is huge land mass of Russian Empire. Russian Empire was bigger than contemporary Russia, but it's mostly the same for now. They are afraid of Russian and they see us like other. They not understand Russian culture, Russian policy. Some people understand, some people love it, but like I told before, the problem of Brussels bureaucracy that depends of Euro-Atlantic pseudo-values. And of course, they see Russia like threat. But if we can cooperate in normal way and to respect each other, to trust each other, it will be prosperity for Europe, because cheap gas, cheap oil, and other resources, and very huge Russian market.
Do you see has the United States had a plan to separate Europe and Russia?
Of course, it's a very old idea to separate main European powers like Germany, like France, from Russia. It's an idea based on some works of American scientists from late 19th century to separate China, Russia, and Germany. For example, it's idea of Helford Mackinder, idea of Spikeman, other geopolitical scientists. And till now, they have a project of decolonize Russia, and I mean it's separate Russia part by part. And,
split Russia up.
Yes, and just to fight with Russia till its end. Of course, we cannot to accept this idea.
And is Europe right to be wary of China, or should they see China as an opportunity for mutual benefit?
I read many books of European after for last decades, and they are total anti-Chinese propaganda. They are afraid of Chinese techniques, about Chinese productions, and they propose idea to develop European goods, but it's not work. There is question, why Europe cannot do it? Why they depend on Chinese goods? It's question to Europe. Another factor is European historical racism, xenophobia, because China civilization is different. The type of Mongoloid type, if we speak about classical anthropology, and Russian seems more like Europeans, but Chinese no. Chinese have totally other type of culture. They have totally logic. Actually, they have not logic in a European sense, in sense of Aristotle, because they think in other way, very specific.
And how important is it that states embrace, because I know you've written about this, how important is it that states embrace religion and tradition rather than the liberalism which is so pervasive in the West?
If we see like liberalism works in progress, it's going to extermination of human being itself. And religion, it means that connect.
Why do you say that? Why do you say it?
Because it started from liberation of church, of human history, of customs, church, tradition, religious, then traditional values, then statehood, because ultimate goal, there should be no state. It should be one world by liberal ideology. globalist. And of course, they need no traditional customs and need no religions, different type of beliefs. But without belief, human being cannot exist. You see that majority of the world are full of any kind of traditions, different type of traditions. Abrahamic traditions like Christian, Muslim, for Judaism, and Buddhism, or even paganism tradition in different corner of the world. So it for millenniums. And why we should accept idea to be without belief, be without religion, if it worked for many, many ages ago? And it support people, and people need it. And there is no any contradiction between a kind of technical development and beliefs. And we can to go to the external space and also believe in God. But, I see no problems. So it's a problem of liberalism itself.
And you are starting to see in Europe and indeed in America kind of coming back of tradition, patriotism, in part Christianity. Do you think that's essential for Europe? For Europe to get rid of this ideology of liberalism and start having more of traditional values and patriotism? Is that the only way that Europe can save itself?
It's more easy to destroy than construct. So for Europeans need to reorganize education, to reorganize state system, to reorganize Ministry of Culture, etc., etc. It's a long way. So it was a very big mistake with multiculturalism. First of all, and also historical mistake with Enlightenment, because they started to produce some very destructive ideas and that supported in other regions and other corners. Of course, it's part of history, it's part of European philosophy, but it should be reversed, I think.
And when do you think the special military operation in Ukraine will end, and what will the world look like when it does?
When the West stop support of Ukraine, at least technically, military, it will be finished very quickly. And of course, Russian leadership has very clear goal to combat neo-Nazism in Ukraine, to combat Ukrainian militarism, and to provide assistance and support to Russian people there, because they are oppressed by contemporary neo-Nazi regime, and not in only eastern, southern regions of Ukraine, but also in the central parts, in the west, because Russian Orthodox Church is prohibited, the other political parties prohibited, that only need to support neo-Nazi regime of Zelensky. So it's a kind of new dictatorship that should be destroyed. It's kind of a new Nazism, and that also should be destroyed. It's also a threat to European countries, because we see a contraband of weapons from Ukraine to different markets through Europe, of course. To also recently it was a scandal in Romanian border, and there was some weapon planet to be go to Israel, and so it's also threat to many countries, not only for Europe.
And why do you think at the moment Trump is trying to push peace in Ukraine, a new deal, and it's the Europeans who are stopping it? How can you explain that Trump is I think genuinely trying to create peace in Ukraine, but it's the Europeans who are stopping it, and when it's European industry that's being damaged, European lives that are being lost. How do you explain that, the difference, the dichotomy of America is trying to create peace in Europe, but it's the Europeans that are blocking it?
I think Trump not understand how politics works. He's businessman, and he personally thinks that maybe the United States will get some benefit from this conflict. Then he tried to understand what Russia means doing this special military operation, and how to stop it, and Putin provide him very clear agenda, why we do it, what should be done, and how we can to stop sanction, how we can to cooperate again with the United States, etc. Maybe Trump think positively in this way, but he more theorist. Also, around him is a lot of hawks, a lot of neoconservatives who would like to continue this war because they have a personal business interest to provide weapons to Ukraine. And there is the problem. But of course, Russia understands very well what happens, understands the interest of European countries, Brussels bureaucracy, understand the position of United States, and we will continue this operation when our goals will be finished.
But why do you think Europe is blocking it, though?
Europe?
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of a Russophobic agenda, mostly, that in European political elites for the moment. Of course, there's a kind of old, good, skilled diplomats understand that the conflict should be stopped, and the problem mostly from Ukraine. I mean, also terroristic acts on Nord Stream pipelines and also other activity of Ukrainian terrorists inside of European countries, what they're doing now in Poland, in Germany, in Italy, etc. The problem for political elites in Ukraine and in European countries.
And finally, are you confident about Russia's future?
I see that Russia's future will be in prosperity, because Russia is, in sense of geopolitics, if autonomous country and autonomous space. We have huge resources. We have autarky. We not depend, a little bit depends of some Western goods, but less and less from year to year. And in this sense, it's good that we started special military operation, and we reorganizing our economic system. We are more close to global East, to global South, and it's also about multipolarity, because more Southern and Eastern powers cooperate with Russia, we cooperate with them, and we less depends on the collective West.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the Akhlaq of Martyrs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to 8Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously when I talk about the akhlaq of martyrs, well, our episodes really are about learning, in a sense, or sort of strengthening our akhlaq, I would say, through some of the beautiful examples we see in the martyrs' lives. Because we know that the martyrs have particularly pure hearts, really were very much on the path of purifying themselves and displayed very beautiful traits. So obviously it goes without saying that good akhlaq and martyrs go together. So just give an example of one of our martyrs, obviously any of the martyrs would suffice for this. So for example, Ibrahim Hadi, one of the famous martyrs from Hall of Defense, was described as basically, he was beautiful. Oh, everyone who met him considered him beautiful. Now, this is because, obviously, the pure-hearted people do have a special light that is visible to others. And there's this tendency of people, no matter how bad the other people's akhlaq is or their background or the way they dress, people sort of are attracted to these good people. And we know that Allah, for sure, and we are taught this, that Allah places the love of the special people in our hearts. So we're all going to be drawn towards these people, towards the martyrs anyway. So just as an example, Ibrahim Hadi was described as very kind, very polite, and he had great morals and good manners. Now, so what does that mean? So what can we do? And obviously, as I talk about the martyrs again and again, I would urge all of us, I include myself, if we haven't really been engaged in reading about the martyrs or watching movies about the martyrs, or even just watching little clips on social media when you find them, this is something we need to do. We need to engage a lot more with the martyrs. Welcome back to 8Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab, and I'm talking about akhlaq, of course, I'm talking about the akhlaq of the martyrs in particular, and I've just started to sort of give a reminder, urge all of us to just become even more engaged with the martyrs, because obviously you're probably well aware that obviously our times throughout the world now are very unusual times, and you know, one of the things we can do if we're aware that, you know, there's so much oppression happening in the world, there's so much cruelty, there's so much violence. Well, rather than fall into a despairing attitude, what we should be doing is strengthening ourselves, strengthening our hearts, improving our akhlaq. Because for sure, this is something that's beneficial for us. We gain greater proximity to Allah, and inshallah, we sort of stay on this path towards Allah anyway. But also, it helps the people around us, because we do need these pure-hearted people. So whether it's our martyrs who are with us, they're certainly not dead, they're truly alive now. Or whether it's our people in our daily lives, so whether if we have really good role models, if, for example, one of our parents or another family member is just a very good, non-judgmental, a very patient and calm person who may be someone that we always go to when we have questions. So let's sort of be directed more towards them to sort of benefit from that. Because, you know, there's the other thing, and this is something that the martyrs, all of them did. When we sort of get closer to the pure-hearted people, the good people, their traits, in a sense, rub off on us. We benefit. So we will then find that our habits improve, our akhlaq improves, because, you know, we even unconsciously, we will start to sort of imitate their words, their way of behavior, and we will adopt their values. If we ourselves do not have the best values yet, then for sure we will probably start to adopt the values, all those good values of the good people. So inshallah, this is just, let's say, a reminder to also make sure whether we're really spending enough time with all the good people we know. And nowadays especially, it's becoming more and more important, inshallah. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AIDS Ed here on Irish Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Thank you for joining us. Hebrew media shed light on the interview conducted by an Israeli newspaper with Tom Barak and the complexities of forming the international force in the Gaza Strip. Other topics included the prospects of escalation against Lebanon. We will discuss these topics with Mr. Khaled Barakat, writer and political researcher, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Mr. Khaled.
Thank you, Barak.
Tel Aviv is expressing strong opposition to the participation of Turkish troops in the international force that is to be deployed in Gaza as per U.S. President Donald Trump's plan, which has caused tensions between the entity and the Trump administration. Could this issue cause a major crisis between U.S. and the Israelis?
I don't think it will cause major crisis. It's a tactical difference position between the U.S. Trump administration and the Netanyahu administration, because this is contradictions within the allies. It's not two camps fighting each other. Mm-hmm. It's the allies and the friends of the United States who are disputing what to divide and how to divide tasks between each other. Turks want, you know, the Turkey wants more, Israel wants more. They want to talk about, you know, if, you know, Turkey is going to be involved in Gaza, then how come they don't want us in Syria? And so, basically, this reflects a contradiction within the same camp, competing, not conflict in a major way, but at the same time, the absence, it reveals the absence of the Arabs.
So you're saying that Turkey is in the Western camp?
Absolutely. The Turkey is a member of the NATO, mm-hmm. NATO, you know, and at the same time, when we look at the relationship between Turkey and Israel, not Erdogan and Netanyahu.
Okay.
Turkey, the state, and Israel, the Zionist entity. There is we're talking about $5 to $6 billion, trade annually. We're talking about a very strategic agreement in military, intelligence, you name it. And both are friends and allies of the United States. Now, the U.S. administrations these days wants to tell the Israelis that you cannot play our role in the region. You have to come to Washington. That's why they tell Netanyahu, come to Washington. Mm-hmm. Because also, basically the boss is in Washington. And so if you guys disagree with each other, and, you know, we love you all, But you have to come to Washington so we can intervene and sort
to take
this
the blessings
out. Absolutely, and to because as Barak said, the problem is not these things between Israel and Turkey. The problem is Iran. So even when Iran has nothing to do with actually these kind of contradictions between Turkey and Israel, the United States would rather blame Iran even for these kind of contradictions.
Okay, but how important is this partnership with Turkey to the Trump administration?
I think that...
Because they are insisting and persisting that they should be part of this new phase.
I think the dispute between them is not just on Gaza. The real problem between Turkey and Israel is Syria. And Syria is the absent word here. The Turks wants to basically be the major force in Syria. Israel is occupying, you know, Syrian lands, not to mention the Golan Heights. And at the same time, they're not very comfortable with Israel bombing Syria.
Okay,
on a daily basis.
These are the disputes, but how important is it, is this partnership with Turkey to the Trump administration?
Well,
and you spoke
about
interest between the two sides.
It's very important. The relationship between U.S. and Turkey goes way back. And it is extremely important for the United States that Turkey be satisfied. We're talking about a major regional power in the region. Turkey is not a small country or a small power in the region, and the United States have depended on Turkey on so many issues and so many files before the, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to the extent that you know, Turkey gets basically almost what Israel gets with some kind of
modifications,
and every time Turkey wants to.
So it's a true competition here.
Competition.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, U.S. envoy to Syria Tom Barrat discussed the issue of Turkey ties with the occupation entity in an interview with the Jerusalem Post.
If you pick up the Turkish papers in the morning, you look at the Greater Israel. They say the objective is Israel is going to go from Venice to Dubai.
F-35 in Turkish hands is not a problem for Israel?
Oh, I think it is a problem for Israel. I think Israel is deathly against it, but that's a ways off.
Is there also a normalization path between Erdogan and Netanyahu that you see?
I do. I'll be hung up in the Turkish press again tomorrow by saying it. Yes. It makes so much sense. There's only one real problem, which is Iran. The rest are not problems.
Why does Israel appear to be concerned with Turkey playing an enhanced regional role?
Because, again, Israel wants to dominate. Israel feels that it has the surplus power and the U.S. support and the Western support that Turkey doesn't have in the same level. And they feel that this is a chance for them to dominate the region. And so when, you know, greater Israel for the Israelis does not mean to send Israeli, you know, occupation forces to, I mean, if they can, they will, but to Jordan and Iraq and Kuwait. And the idea is to dominate the region, to be the power that nothing happened without its consent and its approval. And Turkey feels that this is too much. And particularly...
Fight over influence in the region?
Influence, but at the same time, in the last 2 years, is not like before. After October 7th, the entire region rejects Israel. Israel is not a normal part of this region. And that's why it is important and is in the interest of Turkey and Iran, for example, to work together. It is important for the Arabs and Turkey and Iran to work together because they are natural, you know, part of our region. The problem is Israel, not Iran. And when Barak said that we can solve these issues, but the problem is Iran, well, actually, we can solve these issues, but the problem is Israel.
So you're saying that Israel views Turkey as an obstacle in its Israeli in its hegemony towards the region, especially the expansionist plan of the greater Israel.
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at the history, I mean, wars happen between sometime same camp. The World War One, for example, happened between European forces and capitalists. They're all capitalists. There is an intensifying moment in the region,
mm-hmm.
and Turkey feels that it can actually have a more influence than Israel, being, seeing that Israel is isolated today in the world.
So they can take advantage of that?
Yes.
Okay, however, do you think that Washington is in the process of settling these dilemmas or some of the disputes between Turkey and Israel for the sake of the second phase of the Gaza Agreement?
At the expense of the Arabs. They will,
they will do that. They will solve the dispute between the two sides?
Yes, at the expense of the people of the region.
Will Turkey apply that? Will Turkey accept it?
I'm not sure if Turkey is going to go all the way with U.S. plans, because, again, Turkey understands that Trump is just a phase. And, you know, the relationship with Trump is excellent with Turkey. It's not like, have you ever seen Trump, criticizing Israel? He always called Erdogan a very close friend, an ally, special friend.
Yeah, but also on the same time, you're saying on the expense of the Arabs, but also Trump has good relationships with the Arabs. He just got trillions of dollars from Saudi Arabia.
Yes, I'm not talking about these Arab monarchist regimes and reactionary regimes.
Okay.
I'm talking about the Arab people. I'm talking about Syria and Lebanon and Palestine. I'm talking about our region here.
Okay.
It will
neighboring
be.
Neighboring countries.
Absolutely. And the people interest, the nation interest, not the government interest. The entire Arab regime today is submitting to U.S. I mean, I don't see any Arab state even willing to criticize the United States. I mean, some Algerian ambassador criticized mildly the United States, he was gone. I mean, we're talking about Algeria, not like, Saudi Arabia. So no one dares now to even talk or criticize the U.S. We are dealing with regimes that they have total submission to U.S. hegemony. They are rushing normalization with Israel. They are cooperating with Israel, especially the Gulf countries, on a daily basis, not just in terms of economy,
but even
security.
Yeah, but do you think that Barak actually indulged in such sensitive topics and shared it on public, especially on the Jerusalem Post, just to shed the light on one factor, that Iran is the problem? Because that's what they concluded from that interview.
Iran is the elephant in the room that they don't want to, but he is very frank and open, and he say it as is. And sometimes you need to hear it.
What did he mean to say that?
It just to blame someone else, and to use Iran as a, a name.
A pretext?
I say a cry crow or whatever they call that, to just scare people, scare. And not just, if Iran, for example, if he didn't use Iran, he could have said terrorism is the problem, or Hezbollah is the problem, or Hamas is the problem.
He deliberately mentioned it that way.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. And he knows that he's doing this in order to remind the allies that you should be united against Iran. And they're failing to do that. They've been working day and night to build a coalition against Iran.
Yeah, obviously by shedding light on the Turkish role, especially the relationship between Turkey and Trump, is to like diverge the situation from Turkey as an enemy to Iran as an enemy. Do you agree to that scenario?
They never viewed
to Israel, of course.
They never viewed Turkey as an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Turkey is an ally.
Yes.
And if Turkey
to
was...
To the Israelis.
Absolutely.
To the Israelis, we're saying.
It's a competition.
Because
like
the competition is intense between the two sides.
Yes, I mean, in Germany and France, they compete. Britain and, Germany, they compete. And they actually, when you read, like Canada and the U.S., they competed. They had a dispute, over many things. But they're allies. No one would question that Canada is not an ally of the United States.
Okay, in the same interview with the Jerusalem Post, Barak referred to the ongoing contacts between the Netanyahu and Gilani administrations to reach an agreement between the two sides. How likely is it an agreement can actually occur between a Gilani and Netanyahu?
What Netanyahu wants from Syria is a total submission. They want the new Syrian regime to come walking on their hands and legs to submit to Israeli conditions. And Israel is not willing to withdraw from one inch of the occupied Syrian territories or from the Golan Heights. And the regime in Syria today is experiencing a new challenges. One is that the people of Syria, regardless of how much you can deceive some, you know, people at certain point of time, they are really looking at this as a submission. And we hear more and more popular voices in Syria saying that we cannot accept Israeli aggression on our land. We cannot accept any kind of relationship with Israel based on Israel keeping, you know, the Israeli, the Syrian occupied land. And even in the ceremonies that they did on 1 year of the so-called victory, people spontaneously in the streets of Damascus were shouting against Israel, against occupation. They were shouting for Gaza and for the resistance. And I think that...
So an agreement is likely, in your opinion?
I don't think so.
But Jolani is not showing any lack of submission, as you're highlighting.
Absolutely, but they want more. Because
more, such as?
They want a total submission. They don't want to give
from the people of Syria?
No, from this regime in Syria. They don't want, okay, if there is...
But they don't
notice,
show any...
Notice how they call it security
criticism.
Agreement. They're not calling it agreement. They're not calling it even peace agreement. They're calling it security agreement.
Yes.
Security agreements means that Israel will keep all the...
troops.
Syrian land,
okay.
Including, you know, Jabal al-Sheikh, they're beginning, the Israelis, to call Syrian areas with Hebrew names. Basically, they're saying this is the mountain of Harmon, this is a sacred mountain about, you know, a Sheikh mountain, Jabal al-Sheikh. They're already advocating for this is the permanent status. And they want to keep the pressure.
Okay, so the total submission and not staying in those lands that they occupied, the Syrian lands. That's the kind of submission that you are talking about.
According to Barak, this needs to have an arrangement. You know, he could say, for example, well, yeah, Israel withdraw from Syrian land like before.
Yes.
You know, the so-called peace for land era. We're not that era anymore, peace for land anymore. Today, what Barak and his, you know, administration wants is to impose new realities.
Okay.
Basically, Israelis will remain in Syria and the Syrian regime have to submit.
Despite that factor. Okay. An interesting statement made by Barak in this interview is that the Turkish, and he said that the Turkish intelligence assisted in intercepting Hezbollah convoys in Syria. First of all, how accurate do you think the statement is? And if it's true, can it be considered as a way to improve ties between Turkey and Israel?
I think that this will condemn Turkey's role in Syria. Is this is Turkish role in Syria? Is to stop you know, any arms coming to the resistance, if we assume that this is correct and it's true. And if it's not true, then why they're not responding to him saying that?
Do you think
this
it's
is
true?
Not true?
Do you think it's actually happened?
Absolutely. These are allies.
Turkish intercepted Hezbollah convoy?
Yes, Farah, because when we talk about this relationship, it's not just media relationship or they have some kind of committee that they're talking with each other. We're talking about, you know, strategic agreements that between the United States and Turkey. Between the United States and you know, these regional power, and this is serious. This is committees who meet daily. This is defense stuff, intelligence, all kinds of, you know, relationship, and it's 24/7.
Okay, but by shedding light on this aspect, do you think the major reason here is to consider a way to improve the ties between the Israelis and the Turkey?
Yes.
Even if you agree that the Turkish actually stopped this convoy.
Absolutely. He's trying to sell the Israelis that Turkey in Syria is good.
Okay.
Basically, that it's better for Israel if Turkey is in Syria, because that's what they're doing. They're stopping arms to reach Hezbollah.
Now to the occupied West Bank, where a senior officer in the occupation army warned of individual Palestinian attacks against Israeli forces and settlers, underscoring that this is an imminent danger that must be addressed. Why do you think the potential or the issue of a potential lone wolf Palestinian attack is being raised now?
Because they're trying to justify settlers' actions against Palestinian people. Settlers in the West Bank is basically militias, armed militias by the army and by the Israeli government, protected by the army. And the the ones who are committing crimes against Palestinians is not just the Israeli army, but also these organized gangs and militias. And there are 12 organizations that they have almost 360,000 rifles by Ben-Gavir and by the government.
Supported.
Supported. Mm-hmm. Each Israeli settlement is basically a military camp. Each Israeli colony in the West Bank have a training ground, have weapons, and have even jails.
Yes.
Where sometimes they keep Palestinians for a few days, and then they transfer them to the army.
Okay.
And so they're trying to justify the crimes of the settlers.
Our time is up. Thank you very much. Mr. Khaled Barakat, writer and political researcher, thank you.
Warm greetings once again to all our dear listeners around the world. You're listening to Iran Radio. Iran Radio is here, and you are listening to some interesting facts about Islam. Muslims believe they are members of a worldwide Muslim community known as the Ummah, united by a religious bond that transcends tribal, ethnic, and national identities. The first mosque built in the U.S. was the Mother Mosque of America, which was built in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in 1934. It is still used for worship today. Let's see what this next hour holds. Coming right up, it's news this hour. Then we have Minbar. After that, tune in for another special session of radio productions. And closing the hours, don't miss Leader's Speech. Thanks for joining us. Up next, news this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The World Health Organization warns about Gaza's deteriorating health conditions, and most of the territory's hospitals and health centers are just partially functional. Protesters in Venezuela condemn U.S. military's recent seizure of an oil tanker, declaring their readiness to defend their independence against foreign intervention. And at least two people are killed in a shooting attack at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island. Officials say attacker is still at large. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the World News. Israel has carried out fresh attacks in Gaza in further violation of the ceasefire with Hamas. Southern cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah are among areas that have witnessed new strikes. And to hear more on Israeli violations in Gaza, we're there joined by our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, out of Deir al-Balah.
Since the beginning of the U.S. broken ceasefire agreement, from time to time, we are still hearing the Israeli artillery shelling targeting the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah city, the eastern parts of Al-Maghazi and Al-Ibrej refugee camp while we are here in the middle area, and also the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city, which was the focal point of the Israeli attack since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement. To the eastern parts of Gaza city as well, the Israeli attacks are continuous on the eastern parts of Al-Sha'af neighborhood, the eastern parts of Al-Tufah and Al-Shija'iyah, and in addition to this, the northern parts of Jabalia refugee camp and the northern parts of Beit Lahia as well. In the past 24 hours, we have witnessed 8 Palestinians killed as a result of Israeli attacks on different areas. One Palestinian man